The case for argument is Dewitt v. Proctor Hospital. Mr. Williamson.
Good morning, members of the court. Niall Williamson appearing for a second time in the case of Dewitt v. Proctor Hospital. I won't accentuate the facts because of the first opinion. I'd like to point out to you that the insubordination defense now used by Proctor Hospital was not present at the time of the first opinion, and we believe that the burden-shifting analysis of McDonnell-Douglas does not apply to that affirmative defense of insubordination. Under that backdrop, when the case went back down to the district court for remand, there were essentially three different opinions given as to what the insubordination was of Phyllis DeWitt. First, there was Linda Buck, the head of human resources, who in her fourth affidavit made a statement that Mrs. DeWitt had been terminated for inappropriate, unprofessional, and disrespectful behavior as a manager. The person who was the decision maker in the case, Ms. Davis, indicated that her opinion of the insubordination was management philosophy, style of management, and consistencies of management styles, and also very different interpretation of chain of command. The district court did not consider or allude to a third basis of the insubordination that was given by the plaintiff herself in the original charge of discrimination, and that was she'd been terminated by Davis for inappropriate phone technique. It simply was not discussed by the district court. As to insubordination, the plaintiff will not argue that insubordination is not a basis to terminate either her case under the ADA Association or ERISA retaliation claims. We point out that the insubordination has not been proven as an affirmative defense, at least under the standards of summary judgment. The district court on this issue, as all other issues in the case we're about to present to you, reached out, grabbed opinions, made credibility determinations as to which opinion should apply, and then applied it against the non-moving party, Phyllis DeWitt, in the case, contrary to all of this court's cases and decisions relating to standards relating to summary judgment. There were four essential evidentiary issues that were unrelated to insubordination. I'd like to get to those quickly and then get back to insubordination. As to the issue of bonuses being paid to Phyllis or Linda Buck and Mary Jane Davis, there was a clear error in the district court's opinion. And this error was understandable because the district court was citing testimony of Ms. Davis in her deposition, in which she either was mistaken or lied, because she said she did not get any discretionary bonus in the years 2004 and 2005. And I did not put the interrogatory answers of the defendant in plaintiff's response to the motion for summary judgment. Neither did the defendant allude to the interrogatory answers in its subsequent
reply. How large is Proctor Hospital?
The small entity, Your Honor. This is an entity that made $3 to $4.2 million net profit in 2004, $4.2 million in 2005. And it's a good point you bring up, but with a $3 billion corporation, then an $8,000 or $9,000 bonus, which Mrs. Buck actually got in 2004 and 2005, wouldn't appear to be nearly as material.
What was the basis of the bonus?
The bonus was based on what they call a metric system, but it's simple to understand, I think. The hospital had gross receipts and deducted all of their expenses from their gross receipts, and the medical bills for each participant, which of course was up to $250,000 per calendar year, was a zero sum. In other words, they would start off the year, they'd have no money in the account, or at least the overage from the prior year, and then they would take money from their gross receipts, deposit it in a designated fund to pay the self-insured portion of the participant's plan for medical expenses. So they could have a year where they might have $700,000 in medical expenses that was their responsibility. They might have a year where they have $200,000. They didn't know and didn't have any manner or basis for determining how much the medical bills were going to be year to year. And the eight top administrators at Proctor Hospital were the only ones receiving incentive bonuses or any reference you want to make to bonuses, including Linda Buck, including Mary Jane Davis. Those individuals had a clear and obvious...
Tell me what the incentive was.
The incentive was to keep the medical bills down as much as possible so they could increase their bonuses. There'd be more money available to pay their bonus. Mary Jane Davis was well aware of Anthony DeWitt's prostate cancer from 2001 when Mrs. DeWitt was hired up until August 3rd of 2005 when she was terminated. She'd had numerous discussions, as you recognized in the first opinion.
I don't think you're answering the question. What is the formula for awarding a bonus, say, to Linda Buck? She's the human resources...
Yes, sir. I think it has various factors. Profitability of the corporation, cost of that particular department. I mean, there are numerous factors, and I'm probably not qualified to give you a good answer as to how you would determine the exact mathematical computation. But it is in the record. The chief financial officer's testimony is in the record. So is both the testimony of...
But it's not pinpointed on this item of the expenses of paying for the illnesses of relatives, is it?
Sir?
You're talking here about paying for her husband's medical expenses. It's not tied to that item by any means, as I understand it.
The incentive of keeping down the amount of medical bills for any participant in the plan would always be there for each of these eight persons getting a bonus. It isolating that issue, if someone had control over the ability to lower those medical bills, they would...
Anything that reduces the company's costs increases its profits and so increases the potential bonus pool.
Yes, sir.
The question is there anything more specific about how these bonuses are computed? Is there a formula of some sort? So you'd know exactly what financial stake Davis and Burke had in getting DeWitt off the payroll so that it would reduce their medical expenses.
There is a formulary. It's done at the end of the year, and it's done, I think, by the chief financial officer and two other members of a committee based on a formulary.
Well, what is the formula?
I can't elucidate for you the mathematical computation method, Your Honor. I think that if you...
Well, I mean, the issue is how plausible is it that this incentive had something to do with wanting to get rid of this employee, right?
I think it's very plausible. And Mary Jane Davis only...
It would be plausible if you could tell us what the formula is.
I cannot.
So we'd know how a saving of, you know, $50,000 or whatever in medical costs would translate into the bonus entitlement of Davis and Burke, right?
I'm going to suggest to you, and this is out of memory, that the formulary as it relates to gross profit is about 30% of the basis of the computation of the bonus. In other words, looking at the gross profit of the person's department that they run relates to about 30% of how that bonus is going to be calculated on an annual basis. And I think that's in the record. I'd like to move on, if I could, quickly to the outlying committee, because this is a situation where, in the first decision, the district court basically referred to the comment about outlying. And by that, in September of 2004, Mary Jane Davis says to Mrs. DeWitt, there's a three-person committee. Your husband's bills are too high. He's a high outlier.
Lost with this business about the bonuses. Now, Buck, wasn't she the human relations officer?
Yes, sir.
Well, she that's not a profit center. She doesn't have a department that generates profits.
I think there's a basis for referencing her as well as all the other
eight
individuals.
What is the basis of her bonus? It can't be a percentage of the profits that she generates, because she's not a profits, human relations, not a profit center.
In the same sense, neither would the CEO of the company be.
Yes, I know. So I'm asking, what is the basis on which Burke's bonus would be computed? Would it be the aggregate profits of the company? That would be a possibility.
I think that's a fair statement, aggregate profits.
Well then, the contribution that getting rid of DoIt made to the net profits of the corporation would be modest, and how that would benefit Buck be small, wouldn't it?
Maybe, Your Honor, but it's their perception, the actor's perception, of what they can do about Anthony DeWitt's medical bills.
I thought you were going to tell us why this was not insubordinate on her part.
I was going to get to that. My time has run out. She's not. There's nothing about her conduct when she's sitting on a boat in the middle of a lake in southern Illinois discussing a scheduled meeting that would constitute insubordination. Nor did the defendant ever bring up this issue in their response to the charge of discrimination or even the first time before this court. It was all after the fact, formulated after the fact, and based on very insubstantial reasons, members of the court. And I understand you're not a personnel committee. We fully recognize that from your decisions. But a company can't simply make up a reason to justify a termination when their real reason, shown by the circumstantial and direct evidence, is the ability and the need to terminate that employee to eliminate her husband's medical bills.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Williamson. Mr. Davis?
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. I'm Roy Davis, along with my partner, Richard A. Russo. We represent Proctor Hospital. It is undisputed that Phyllis DeWitt, number one, openly questioned whether she wanted to continue working for Proctor Hospital. Number two, professed having a, quote, different management style, end quote, than her boss. Number three, threatened to go over her boss's head with her personal grievances. And number four, referred to her boss as, quote, rude and obnoxious. DeWitt admits this behavior, and she admits that this behavior is exactly what caused her boss to question whether or not she wanted her to continue to be an employee of Proctor Hospital. Her boss resolved that question adversely to Ms. DeWitt. None of the issues giving rise...
Well, I don't know if it was cause for firing just to say you want to go over your boss's head. That happens all the time.
If that
sometimes
had only...
they say you can do it, and sometimes they let you do it.
If that was standing alone, Your Honor, I would agree with you with respect to that point. But unfortunately, it's tied in with these other three issues which kind of tip the decision. Against this backdrop, Ms. DeWitt represents that she has this convincing mosaic of evidence that she was fired on account of her husband's medical bills. And her argument does not withstand serious scrutiny. The first piece of her mosaic is this high-dollar outlier committee that she says was reviewing medical bills. We spent hours deposing the chief financial officer, the chief executive officer, the vice president of nursing, the vice president of human services, and none of them have any knowledge of such a committee even existing. The only person who claims to have any knowledge of that committee is Ms. DeWitt. Her knowledge is clearly hearsay because she claims that someone else told her that this committee exists. This piece of the mosaic does not fit. The second piece of her mosaic relates to the incentive income.
No, it's not inadmissible if Davis, as the agent of the hospital, you know, made an admission about the committee, right?
I think under the rule, for her statement to be an admission, it has to be something within the scope of her employment
right.
with the hospital. There is no evidence, and in fact, the evidence
She's
is
the head nurse.
Having nothing to do with claims review whatsoever.
So I see. She's not...
Right. The second piece of her mosaic, again, is back to this incentive income issue. From the court's questioning, I'd like to skip right to my portion of this argument and point out that this incentive plan is a plan prepared by Towers Perrin for the hospital, and it's attached to, I believe, Mrs. Buck's affidavit. At page 6 of that plan, you'll see that the plan had nothing to do with net profits. In order for the persons eligible to participate in the plan, there had to be a certain amount of income from operations at the hospital, not net profits. And at pages 13 and 17 of the plan, you will see the specific goals set forth for Ms. Buck and Ms. Davis, and those relate nothing to saving on medical costs. In fact, both of their goals were based on retention of employees. With respect to Ms. Buck, it was retention of all employees in the hospital, and with respect to Ms. Davis, it was retention of registered nurses. So the firing of Ms. DeWitt adversely affected their incentive under the incentive plan.
Was she a registered nurse? Or
registered nurse. So I think one more piece of the mosaic bites the dust. The third piece of her mosaic relates to hospice discussions had between Ms. Davis and Ms. DeWitt. As the district court notes, this is a medical facility. It was commonly known that Ms. DeWitt's husband suffered from prostate cancer. It was discussed widely among the nursing staff, including Ms. DeWitt and her boss. Hospice discussions came up in 2004.
Does Proctor have a hospice?
Proctor does not have a hospice. In answer to your earlier question, Proctor is a 750-bed hospital.
It doesn't have any affiliation with a hospice?
It may have some tangential affiliation, but as somebody who's been doing work for a hospital for 30 years, I'm not aware of any. The fourth and last piece of her mosaic has to do with the financial condition of the hospital. The hospital was actually enjoying its salad years from 2003 to 2005. In 2003, its gross revenues were $180 million, went up steadily to $240 million by 2005. I hate to say profit, that's not exactly correct in a not-profit, but its net income started at $3 million in 2004 and was up to $4.2 by 2005. So it's not like they were in a position where they were starving and losing money and had to cut costs. I respectfully submit...
What would have been the financial expense to the hospital if she had remained employed and her husband had continued to expensive treatment?
Wouldn't have made any difference because she prepaid her COBRA at the time of her termination. The hospital paid all of his medical expenses. Unfortunately, he passed away, and so there was a net no gain, no loss with respect to her medical expenses.
Isn't it true that... the plaintiff here got very good reviews from her superiors before this incident of where she flipped off to the nurse.
That is accurate, Your Honor.
In other words, this came out of the blue, I gather, in terms of behavior. Is that right?
Over a period of about 8 hours, it came out of the blue.
Well, it took 8 hours so for all this conversation to take place?
It took an entire day, and as my worthy opponent points out, the lady was on her day off. That is true. But at this level of administration within a hospital of this size, your days off aren't necessarily something that are inviolate. You're going to get calls.
How long had Davis been her supervisor?
Davis hired her, all since she worked there, and I think it was about 3 or 4 years. Your Honors, if there's no other questions, I really don't have anything to add beyond what's in my brief.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Thank
Davis.
You.
Mr. Williamson, how much time? You have no time, but we'll give you. Would you like another?
Thank you, Your
Honor. Sure.
And I will try and be short. The entire conversation relating to insubordination is shown in the record by Ms. Davis' testimony. is a five-minute conversation at 4 o'clock in the afternoon discussing the scheduling of a meeting, not immediate urgent patient care, the scheduling of a meeting. Secondly, on the outlier issue, I want to make sure I've said to the court on this issue of hearsay relating to Davis's statement to DeWitt, the defendant never raised this issue in its motion for summary judgment. Page 12 of the brief quotes their entire argument in the motion. Proctor does not have such a committee, and Buck is the only individual at Proctor privy to such information. We have no objection to the district court exercising discretion on evidentiary issues. It reached out to grab this issue and this argument about hearsay because the defendant never did it.
Well,
and
I don't understand. If they deny that there was such a committee and you come back and say, well, Davis admitted there was such a committee, they can certainly come back and say, yes, but her admission is not admissible hearsay because it was outside her...
Absolutely, Judge. They did not do that. The district court did it. If you go back and look at their...
I don't understand.
Well, because this court has several decisions, one of which I've cited, a 2007 case, where you indicate that if a defendant, a party, does not argue an issue in the district court, they can't do it in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals.
No, that's different. That's where you're sandbagging the district judge. But if the district judge just, you know, decides... to exclude evidence, even though he hasn't been asked to do so, there's nothing wrong with that.
I certainly accept the court's comment. I don't believe the discussion of it.
They don't have to be entirely passive. If a judge, especially on evidentiary, you know, a judge may say, "Look, the defendant may not object to this inadmissible evidence, but I don't want to have all this inadmissible evidence. It just clogs up the works." There's nothing wrong with
that. Your Honor, the discussion that you ask of Mr. Davis assumes that, I suppose, that there was no such committee. We still don't agree with that. We believe there was such a committee. And if she was on that committee, then she...
The only evidence is Davis, right? You have no other evidence that there's such a committee.
That's true. But if there was such... Well, Judge, if they had such a surreptitious committee, we wouldn't expect any meetings, we wouldn't expect any notes, we wouldn't expect anything.
You can't. You can't base a claim on the fact that if the defendants have done something wrong, they would have concealed it, and therefore you have no evidence, right? You can't do that.
But, sir, the issue is whether it's hearsay, and all I'm saying is she is saying that in the course of her conduct as an employee based as a member of that committee.
Member of the committee?
Yes, sir. And I think it's admissible from that standpoint as an admission.
Okay.
May I have your attention, please?
Okay, thank you to both counsel.
A fire has been reported in this